Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, advice is everywhere, but it's not all good. We talk about how to tell if the advice you're getting, whether it's from friends, parents, strangers on the internet, is good or should be ignored. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum.
We recently received a question from Elizabeth Renner of Madison. She asked us, through WPR's Wisconsin Project, why are tubas such a prominent part of the UW-Madison band? And why are they so popular in Wisconsin? WPR's Tim Peterson marched right down to the Madison campus to get some answers.
The tuba has a long and deep history in Wisconsin. In the mid-1800s, a lot of Germans immigrated to the area, bringing their music, their refreshments, and their instruments with them. That's according to John Stevens, a longtime tuba performer and composer in Wisconsin. He's also professor emeritus of music at UW-Madison.
The basic German culture of the state, I think, has a lot to do with it. Polka bands, bands and beer, if you will.
But the tuba and polka music really got oompa-pa-ing around the Civil War era. Military band music was popular, with big names in Wisconsin like the Broadhead Brass Band. Fast forward to today. The tuba is still very much alive and well, especially on UW's campus. Looking into the tuba questions made me want to know more about what it's like to be a tuba on Wisconsin football game days.
Before the game, we'll actually parade around the city and go to some of the different places on Regent Street and play right up close to the crowd there.
That's Gabe Kepke. He's a tuba player in the UW marching band. The iconic band dates back to 1885, just 2 decades after the end of the Civil War. It started as a military-style ensemble, a bit smaller than today's group. Another tuba player is Max Collins. He says the band has a protocol for how members are supposed to act in uniform. But as tubas,
we get to mess with people a little bit more. If we see fans in the opposing colors, we kind of just play at their face a little bit.
Then there's the pregame and halftime performances at Camp Randall.
We're so big, you can see the bell from anywhere in a stadium.
That's Joseph Klug, another UW tuba player.
I know other instruments, they have hats with massive plumes on them, and so you can clearly tell whenever they're looking around. For us, it's you can clearly tell if we're facing the wrong way.
Corey Pompey is the UW marching band director and associate director of bands at UW-Madison. He says the notes tubas play are the roots of every chord, the bass lines that everything else the band plays are built on.
It's just an important sound, an important voice in the band that we just have to have.
During game day performances, the tubas assert themselves with a couple of additional antics. One of Kepke's favorites is when the tuba section builds a human pyramid. And in a tradition going back to the 1950s, the tubas famously embark on a march around the field during the second half.
We play a version of On Wisconsin, that's all tuba. We also play a version of You Said It All, that's all tuba. So when we're going around and playing the melody for people, it's like, it makes you feel like a star. It's awesome.
Pompey agrees. Pompey also says he enjoys just being around the tubas. They're fun. They tell jokes. They don't take things too seriously.
I should also note that it's an extremely hard-working group of people, and you have to be in order to carry that heavy instrument around for as long as they do.
And they just have a special bond. Collins says it's something he loves about being a UW tuba.
All 20 of us pretty regularly kind of hang out, so having that many people that you're just close to just because you are really makes it feel like you belong somewhere and really makes you feel like a part of something.
So keep an eye out for this pack of rhinos, as they call themselves, next game day, especially if you're not wearing cardinal red and white.
WPR's Tim Peterson brought us that piece on tubas in Wisconsin. And that story idea came through WPR's Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future story. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now it's easy to find advice in this world. Friends and family, randos on the internet, everyone can be a source of advice, even if you didn't ask for it. So how are we supposed to know if someone's opinion, whether it's a professional opinion or an unsolicited one, is actually worth listening to? Advice giving and taking is an age-old pastime. Historians say advice columns have been around for at least 300 years. Our next guest interviewed advice-giving experts to get some advice about how to figure out what advice to take and what to trash. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What's the best advice you've ever gotten? What's the worst advice you've ever gotten? Do you try to share advice with other people? When and where and when do you just clam up and listen? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Allie Volpe is a senior reporter at Vox. Allie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
What led you to seek advice about advice for your piece, Allie?
Yeah, it's funny. It is a little meta. A lot of what I cover does require me reaching out to experts and getting their advice on a variety of topics. And a workplace discussion kind of veered down this topic of like, well, what advice is good advice? And so I was kind of working with the working headline of advice about advice. So I figure, you know, if we are doling it out, we might as well teach people what advice to take and what to ditch.
Now, in general, there have been some studies on this, and it sounds like getting advice, if we do it right, it can help us make better decisions. What do we know?
Right. Like we all know what we know and we don't know what we don't know. We have our biases. We have our blinders up to certain things. There was studies that actually showed if you got advice from a sports fan who was a fan of a team you weren't rooting for, you made a better bet on how the game would resolve if you, you know, took their advice instead of just going with your gut, hoping that your preferred team would win. So taking advice does help us make better decisions, but we're not very good at taking that advice, even if we've asked for it ourselves, research shows.
How do we make sure we're getting advice that might actually confront our blind spots as opposed to so-and-so thinks, we don't think this out loud probably, but so-and-so thinks like I do, they'll back me up in this decision I'm making, whether it's right or not. How do we make sure we're getting a positive committee, not a yes men kind of committee?
Right. I think it's important to think about who's giving the advice. Is it somebody who has expertise in the area we're looking for advice in? I maybe wouldn't go to my best friend for legal advice if they do not have that sort of expertise. So I think it's important to look at where that advice is coming from, because maybe oftentimes a close friend or a family member might just be saying what they think we want to hear and instead of what we actually need to hear.
Now, if we don't want to hear advice, how can we put ourselves, or the advice that's going to help us, how do we put ourselves in a mindset to say, okay, this isn't what I wanted to hear. Maybe I need to take it seriously, though.
So what I found interesting from reporting this piece is sometimes we do get that advice that is like, I don't want to do this. This feels hard. This feels difficult. But sometimes that's what we need to do. I found it interesting that people often take advice when it is it aligns with our life, it addresses a problem, and it's feasible to achieve, and it doesn't have any major consequences or side effects. So sometimes good advice just comes in bad packages. Like sometimes a parent might tell us advice in a condescending manner, or advice might feel that it is too difficult. But sometimes we just need to take a step back and think about it. That bit of advice that we maybe thought was too hard or didn't align with our lives maybe is the thing we should do. I talked to an advice columnist who talked about someone who wrote in asking for advice on whether to ask out somebody who they had a crush on. And so the hard thing to do would to give the advice of yes, ask out that person. That is a vulnerable thing that sometimes might give us butterflies. It might feel bad, but it's the right thing to do. Sometimes the hard thing or the thing that gives us the negative reaction is the right thing to do.
We asked around here at Wisconsin Public Media. Aaron Cook, one of our HR people, says the first thing I always try to do is filter the advice through several lenses. Is this advice helpful or hurtful? The result of knowledge and experience versus bias. Is it a judgment or an actual critique on any sort of content? Finally, I consider where the advice is coming from and where I stand in relation to it. Who's the expert? Is this something creative or emotional? A long line of filters there for advice. Allie, Aaron is clearly thinking about ways to figure out what advice is good or not. What did you hear from experts when it came to evaluating advice in those ways?
Yeah, definitely the panel of getting a lot of different opinions was something that experts definitely sang the praises of. Getting a number of different viewpoints helps us to consider all angles that we maybe didn't consider. But then there comes a point where if you are just asking dozens and dozens of people, maybe you haven't really thought about what you actually want. So it is helpful if you can get a clear consensus from a panel of a handful of people. But if you feel the need to keep asking people, you probably just don't know what you want.
We're talking about how to tell if we're getting good or bad advice with Allie Volpe, senior reporter at Vox. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you tell if you're getting good advice or bad advice? Any advice you regret taking or not taking in your life? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about sorting out good advice from bad with Allie Volpe. She's a senior reporter. She wrote about this at Vox. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Ellen is with us in Peterborough. Ellen, hi.
Hi. Oh, this one is kind of odd. I was in a very intense year-long program at Milwaukee Mental Health Complex. I received very good care, and I had a psychiatrist who saw me every week. At the end of that year, his last advice to me was, watch those left turns, Ellen. And as a person who drives a lot, I have found that he was right. But I think it's hilarious that after that, you know, that was his advice.
I love it, Ellen. I thank you for sharing that, Ellen. I like that in part because, okay, we've been through this long experience, but here's some really, I don't know, grounding, very practical advice that's going to help anybody who, in this case, anybody who drives.
Right. Sometimes the most practical thing is the best thing to do. And the advice that sort of takes us by surprise, I find the most memorable and that I will actually use.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Ellen, at 800-642-1234. Yeah, what I hope my kids take away from growing up in my house is careful on the steps, because stairs are great, but yeah, they'd be dangerous if you're not careful on them. Now, looking back at the experts you talked to, Allie, sometimes we offer advice when it isn't really being solicited. How can we be careful not to give that unwanted advice?
Right. And I am so guilty of this sometimes. Sometimes all people want is just to vent. They don't want advice. And I found it's actually just really easy to ask somebody straight up, do you want advice or do you just want me to listen? And no one is ever really offended by that. And oftentimes people just want you to listen. And so I make sure when I'm about to vent to a friend or get their advice, I'll often preface it with, oh, I really want your advice on this, or can I tell you about something? And I think that sort of guides the conversation so you're not getting unsolicited advice.
We heard from Susan in Suamico. She says the best advice she was ever given was from her father when she was pregnant with her first. She said the advice was the best thing to spend on your child is time. Oh, I like that. So that's an example of someone with a specific bit of experience. It was her dad talking about child raising. I don't know. Are there good general kinds of advice that we can reach out to and get that kind of wisdom?
I love that bit of advice. Something an expert told me that really stuck out to me was somebody who's in the quote unquote messy middle of an experience often has really good insight, even though they might feel that they don't. So a parent who maybe has toddlers and they're in the middle of it is better suited to give advice about parenting than maybe someone who's an empty nester, because you are the one who's actually experiencing it every day.
Let's go back to our callers. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Good afternoon. Well, to follow up on an earlier comment, UPS used to instruct their drivers to make 3 right turns on a block instead of taking a left to prevent accidents. But my advice, I'm not sure if it was a line in a movie or on a TV show or something from one of my grandfathers or an uncle or my dad, but it was in the context of an Italian restaurant, and it was simply, don't fill up on bread.
I love it, Tom. And have you lived by this rule?
Actually, I've probably strayed from it, but I think that when I think of it, it means the main course is still coming.
Excellent. Tom, thanks a lot for sharing that. We're asking for your best or worst advice ever given or received. Ali Volpe wrote about how we evaluate advice we get. She's a senior reporter at Vox. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Our own Larry Mueller, host of the Larry Mueller Show here at Wisconsin Public Radio, told us, my high school guidance counselor told me I should not attend UW-Madison, but find a smaller school where I'd have a better chance to succeed. I asked my dad about it, and he said I should go where I want, and if I failed, I could try another school. So Larry says, I went to UW-Madison, succeeded, eventually became a full professor at UW, and had a pretty successful radio career on campus. I would add, Larry, Ali, when we're making a big, or at least what feels at the time like a huge life decision, like where should I go to college or what job should I seek or whatever, what did you learn from the people you interviewed about how to seek out useful advice?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that we tend to favor advisors who are more confident, but those people might not always be the most accurate. So I think it's important to get diverse points of view. Like, we tend to seek out people who are similar to us. So finding people who have a different experience than we do in getting advice can often help lead us in the right direction. So it's funny that the guidance counselor, you know, said one thing, dad said another thing. And so you kind of just take the average of those two bits of advice, which experts say is actually a good way to go.
We'll go back to our callers now. Ganado is with us in Milwaukee. Ganado, hi.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I'd love to see two media sources that I love combined together. I read Ali's articles as well on Vox all the time. But my piece of advice that I wanted to talk about was when I first started grad school, I was not doing super hot because I had just moved to Milwaukee and was starting a new job, and so it wasn't my primary focus in life. I had asked one of my friends who was recently in grad school, like, hey, should I stay with the course or drop it? He suggested that I stay, which not a very good decision because GPA requirements in grad school are very different from undergrad. So I ended up my first semester in academic probation. So, funny story there. I think we both lacked some context, but just wanted to share that.
Well, I hope things got better.
They did. I did graduate, and things turned out fine in the end.
Yay. Okay. Glad to hear that part of it. But, Ali, I think sometimes there's an instinct to say when you give advice, stick to it. Power through. Don't give up. And sometimes giving up, as in the case of Ganado's class, might be the right advice.
Right. And I think that comes back to sort of the criteria that good advice fulfills, you know, whether it solves a problem, is feasible, and doesn't have any consequences. I would argue, you know, spending a lot of money on something that, you know, you might not achieve at is a pretty big consequence or side effect. And therefore, that advice maybe isn't the best.
Thanks a lot for sharing that story. I appreciate it. Now, one expert told you, this is in like broadening horizons here, don't just consider advice from people who have succeeded, right? Because that seems obvious. Seek out people maybe in similar situations who have failed in one way or another. Why is that helpful?
Yeah, one expert gave an example of someone who has been divorced and getting marriage advice from them. They can kind of see the other side. They can see where things have gone wrong, maybe things that they would have done differently. Not to say that we should only be seeking advice from people who have failed something, but they have a unique perspective on, you know, things that didn't go right. That same expert also said getting advice from somebody who, you know, is in the middle of something is really helpful as well. Like somebody who's maybe like in the middle of training for a marathon, but they are like exhausted by it. But giving advice to someone who is a little bit less experienced can help like revive them a little bit and get them excited and remind them why they're doing it.
I want to talk about a source of advice that previous generations weren't lucky enough to have access to, random people on the internet. What did experts say about the advice of, you know, the whole planet online?
Yeah, everyone loves to give advice online. And I think it comes down to just some basic media literacy tips. You know, anyone can post a TikTok telling you how to wake up earlier in the morning. And you might feel susceptible to that. Like, yeah, I can achieve so much more if I got up early. But one, you need to think about, like, do you actually want that advice? Or are you just kind of consuming it passively and think that's something that you might need for your life, but it doesn't actually fit in with your schedule? Something else is like that any person online can put up a video. But what is their credentials? What is their expertise? My colleague, Rebecca Jennings, did this great piece about online influencers posting online courses to their YouTube pages or, you know, getting people to pay money for online courses that they have set up themselves. So do they have any expertise in that? I don't know. Are they just looking to get money? Probably. So if a person is, you know, saying something or doing something to solicit some sort of reaction from somebody, whether that is to be angry or to give them money, I would be skeptical of their advice.
It's a good place to leave it, Allie. We'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Allie Volpe, senior reporter at Vox. She talked to us about her recent article, How to Tell When You're Getting Good Advice. Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. You're here with us on the Ideas Network. We recently received a question from Patricia Meyer from Beaver Dam as part of our Why Wisconsin project. She asked, I am curious about the history of railroads in Wisconsin, especially the early stages of rail transportation in the state. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the history of trains in Wisconsin? What do you find interesting about trains, railroads, their history? Do you go to railroad museums, say? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Daniel Lidke is the curator at the National Railroad Museum in Green Bay. Daniel, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
When do we start to see the first railroads coming to Wisconsin?
Well, we started to see those actually into the 1850s. The year before Wisconsin became a state, the Milwaukee and Waukesha Railroad was chartered in 1847, but they didn't fully complete anything until 1851. And actually in that time, they changed their name. It became the Milwaukee and Mississippi Railroad in 1850. And then on February 25th of 1851, we have our first train ride going from Milwaukee to Waukesha. And that was the first passenger train here in the state.
Yeah, when it comes to the early first couple decades of rail, was it more that kind of thing, passengers, or more freight, say agricultural products moving around and out of Wisconsin?
Yeah, it really was a combination of both. What was interesting, the railroad itself, that first one, Milwaukee and Mississippi, they started in February with that first passenger train, and already by April, they were hauling freight too. They had one passenger and one freight train that would run each day. And then right after that, you started having more railroads coming in. So the Chicago, Milwaukee, St. Paul, and Pacific, or what we typically call the Milwaukee Road, they came up and were forming in the 1850s. The Milwaukee and Mississippi really was kind of the precursor to that railroad. The Chicago Northwestern was coming up from Chicago in the 1850s also. And then you had some other Green Bay and Western in the 1870s, Northern Pacific later on. And really, the big thing was to meet the needs of transporting agricultural goods to the east. So a lot of the wheat, getting that moved to the east. And then really with the passenger side of things, that opened up the state really for Yankee settlers to come in. You know, before that, what you're really looking at with the territory and early statehood, you're looking at the waterways for your transportation. So this was a great way to transport yourself, really, if you're coming into the area for entrepreneurial things or just relocating, and also moved in with the immigrants. So it really opened up immigration to the state.
Bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Lou is with us in Ashland. Lou, hi.
Yeah, I'm my transport driver, and some of my passengers have said that the roads that intersect main roads, like, say, 13, the ones that are kind of at an angle that don't intersect and have sharp corners, and, you know, they'll come in kind of at an angle and then continue on the other side at an angle. And they often say that they are old railroad tracks. And I'm just wondering if there's any validity to that.
Oh, interesting. I had never heard that, Daniel. Do you know anything about that?
You know, and some of them may very well be. It's kind of interesting, especially when you're looking at early towns being developed in our area here in Green Bay. You had the French coming in first, then the British, then the Americans. So they all set up their cities differently. So some were making their plot lines, you know, connecting to the rivers, and some were making more of a grid system. So even here, our streets, all of a sudden you might be driving north, south one way, and there's a bizarre angle because it was an old path, an old street. A lot of the railroads, too, they had to kind of navigate some of those areas by rivers, by other geographic features. So they would try and get, you know, as direct of route as possible, or the easiest route for laying the tracks. So some of those might be, I know too, when you're looking at some of those rails to trails things too, along the cities, those were all the old rail lines. So that they follow those too.
Thanks for the call, Lou, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Daniel Lidke from the National Railroad Museum in Green Bay, talking about Wisconsin's early railroad history, answering a Wisconsin question. We got another question from the UW-Madison Science Outreach Department on Twitter. They asked, I don't know if they're trying to stump us here, they asked, how did the railroad built in 1857 from Madison through what is today's UW-Madison campus and on to Prairie du Chien lead to the naming of the Camp Randall Stadium? I wonder if they know the answer and they're not letting on. I don't know. Daniel, do you know anything about that part of the railroad history?
Well, and that's a great question, too. The Camp Randall itself, and I will immediately apologize to most of the callers here, most of the listeners. I am not big into sports, but I am into history. So the Camp Randall itself that I know more of the history of was the Camp Randall that was formed in 1861 to meet the needs of having a place for new recruits to go and get trained for the Civil War. So Camp Randall was actually named after Governor Randall of the state when when Abraham Lincoln was pushing to get places to get recruits. So the Milwaukee, at that point, it was a Milwaukee and Mississippi Railroad. They did have a line coming into Wisconsin, or into Madison rather. So that was probably the way they were getting troops, new recruits in and out of there. The stadium then, I apologize, I want to say it was early 1900s, 1917. So they still had that rail line, the Milwaukee Road still had a rail line going through to Madison. And they ran trains going into Madison. They actually had into the 40s and 50s, there was a specific train that was going from Chicago to Madison. The Varsity, and that was bringing a lot of people to the games, especially on the weekends or holiday service to the games. So Camp Randall itself was named after the governor for the Civil War stuff, and then the stadium was named after the Civil War recruitment camp itself.
Excellent. Okay, and we also had a Wisconsin question in the past. You can find it at WPR.org on the role of Camp Randall in the Civil War, so you can find a little more about that. Can you talk some about, especially in the 1800s, you were starting to touch on this, how much trains changed our lives, our daily lives, our personal lives, how, where we chose to live if we were Wisconsinites in the second half of the 1800s?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, with anything, when the railroads came through, regardless of what state it was, but specifically here in Wisconsin, when you're looking at the early railroads, with the first railroad, you know, got our first ride in 1851, you had about between 20 to 40 miles. And already by 1880, you've jumped from that 20-mile mark to having over 3,000 miles of rail in the state. So all the railroads coming through, and investors in the railroads, entrepreneurs, you know, seeing the value of this new source of transportation, you know, and that continued well into the 1920s, really was the height of the industry. And then we see a decline. But you're bringing people in, not only for work, for, you know, building their new lives, for coming into the state. And then you're kind of getting into this, you know, what we think of more today with using the railroad for more leisure activities. So you've gone for it really being primarily the industry for moving moving goods or moving people, to starting to get it as more of transportation, vacations. Going back to the Camp Randall thing, sports trains, you had teams, sports teams riding on these trains. You had it bringing people to up to Green Bay for games, to Madison. So it really changes. Even hunting, there would be hunting excursions on these trains on the weekend going up to Loretta, up in Ashland County, Star Lake, Wisconsin. So you've got specific trains, Fisherman Special in the Northwoods, Hiawatha, bringing people up to go hunting and fishing. So it really changed not only bringing people into the state, but how we moved around within the state.
In just our last minute or so, Daniel, can you share one of your favorite or most recent exhibits at the Railroad Museum? I've enjoyed visits there, and my kids certainly did a lot too.
Yeah, this is actually perfect because we have an exhibit right now called Rail Ties, and it's focusing on community stories. So it's really looking at people who either worked for the railroad or had families working for the railroad or had experiences that might be interested in telling us their story, to give oral histories here at the museum, or to, you know, if they want to loan an item and they have a neat story, whether it's a picture or an object, because we really want to preserve that history, both with the oral histories and the objects themselves. But we also want people to realize, you know, trains aren't just those things that you get stuck at by the crossing when you're watching all these freight cars go by. It had a huge impact and continues to have a huge impact on the state. So, yeah, our newest exhibit, Rail Ties, really is trying to get that community engagement and involvement here with the museum, both now and continued.
And briefly, Daniel, if somebody says, yeah, I have a story or an artifact to share, are you still looking for those?
Yeah, absolutely. We started the exhibit at the beginning of the month here, but I'm going to be rotating things out throughout the year. And again, we always want those oral histories too. So any of those items, so they're welcome to contact me here at the museum.
Daniel, thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
That's Daniel Lidke, curator at the National Railroad Museum based in Green Bay. He joined us to help answer a listener question for the Wisconsin Project about the history of trains in the state. We're done riding the rails, but come up, we'll hike and bike on them with a look at rails to trails projects here in the state and beyond. That's next on Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. We just learned about the history of trains in Wisconsin's early years. Staying on track, we're going to answer two more Wisconsin questions related to trains and railroads. Some railroad lines aren't railroads at all anymore, but we can still use them to get around. For some of those abandoned or otherwise removed railroads, they might get turned into a trail system. Typically referred to as a rail trail or rails to trails, these old railroads now offer a place for people to hike or bike. We recently received a couple of questions from John Hansen and Phil Kasnowski from Medford and from Madison. They asked, why was the first rail-to-trail in the nation developed in Wisconsin's Elroy-Sparta area? History, people, groups to thank, how can it be expanded? And also about the history of the rails-to-trails and or other trails in the state. Earlier today, I got some answers to those questions with Eric Oberg, Midwest Regional Director of the Rails-to-Trails Conservancy. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Well, Wisconsin, pretty prominent figure in the rail-to-trail movement. We've got the first one, as I understand it, the Elroy-Sparta Trail. How big a deal was this when this first rail-to-trail in the country got started?
Yeah, it was huge, right? The rail-trail movement really started just a bit south of you guys in the Chicago suburbs, and there was a school teacher, Mary Thielgard Watts, in the 60s that wrote a letter to the editor posing the proposition that the railroad track in her community be turned into a place for people to get out and walk and have a place to go. And that really kickstarted it. Elroy Sparta became the first developed rail trail. So, you know, it was really just a really good idea that happened to meet a perfect time. But it was a slow burn at the very beginning. It's not like it exploded right off the bat, but humble beginnings and in the Midwest, in Wisconsin, in Illinois.
Now, one of our Wisconsin question askers was curious about why that Elroy Sparta Trail, in fact, was converted into a trail. Was there something about that stretch that made it an attractive first developed trail?
Well, it's interesting, right? I mean, I'll start by saying that this movement started really slowly, you know, Elroy Sparta being the first one. And it took almost 20 years for Rail Trail Conservancy to be founded, 1986. And at that point, there was still only 250 miles of rail trail, which may sound like a lot, but today we have over 25,000 miles of rail trail. So what Elroy Sparta did was essentially prove the concept, right? And it was not the easiest thing. If any of your listeners that have been out there, it's the reason it's so wonderful. The tunnels are just unbelievable. But of course, tunnels and bridges are also big, expensive, and complicated pieces of infrastructure. So if you were to think about trying to create the first rail trail, while Elroy Sparta is undoubtedly one of the coolest and most beautiful, and those bridges and tunnels are awesome, they're also really difficult. So it wasn't the easiest, but it maybe it was the best, because it gave people that, you know, when you went out, the people that finally got to go out and see what a rail trail was like, if they went to Elroy Sparta, they were blown away, right? It's really cool. So it wasn't the easiest, but in hindsight, maybe it was the best.
Now, if you've ever tried to walk on a railroad track, it is not pleasant. Biking, less so, I imagine. What does it take? Can you talk about just the efforts to take a length of track, forget the tunnel and bridge for now, and turn it into a trail?
Well, you know, I'm not going to say it's easy, but I will say these corridors were engineered by, you know, the best and the brightest of their day, right? But these railroads really were the cutting edge of transportation when they were designed and engineered and built. So when you think about what they were built to do, to carry tons and tons of train and car, you know, of railroads and cargo, they make the perfect base for a walking and biking trail. And so, you know, you have a lot of the elements that you would need for a trail already in place, a wonderful substrate, you know, that all of that heavy rock and everything that they needed for a train is perfect for, it's over-engineered for a walking and biking trail. So it's just and maybe the most key thing about it, they also went from somewhere to somewhere, right? The railroads weren't building trails they weren't building rail corridors because it was beautiful country and they just wanted to see neat things from the, you know, from the front of the train. The engineer they needed to get things from a place to a place. And that's the beauty of rail trails now. They certainly go through beautiful country, obviously, but they also connect people and communities because that's what the railroads did.
One of our Wisconsin listeners mentioned that within months of moving to Wisconsin, he felt like his local rail trail out of Medford encouraged him to explore his new city and go bike riding. Can you talk about the benefits and how this gets people in many communities outside.
Yeah, I love it. And one of my favorite, one of my favorite sentiments about rail trails was something that one of our founders at Rails to Trails Conservancy said, David Burwell. His dream was that rail trails would become America's Main Street. And that bit of nostalgia about what Main Street used to be, where, you know, families and people would be walking down Main Street and saying hi to each other. And it really was the place where community happened, right? And we've kind of driven, designed, and suburbanized ourselves out of that Main Street community. And trails really have become, trails that go through around communities have become a place where community happens. And so that listener saying he gets on his bike and you know, really enjoys the community he's in, it's because that's where the community is. You're seeing young people, kids, families, old people. You're seeing folks walking, biking, mobility impaired with a wheelchair or otherwise. I mean, every facet of your community is out using that trail. And unlike in your car when you pass people, if you pass people on a trail, it is a personal experience. At the very least, you smile at each other. More often than not, you say hello. Maybe you stop to have a conversation. It's the place where community happens now.
Another listener question. A listener's curious to know if Wisconsin's current rail trails, including Elroy Sparta, could ever be expanded. Do you have your eyes on any trail expansions, especially in Wisconsin, in the works?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's one of the most exciting evolutions of the trail movement, and really the evolution in the way that Rails to Trails Conservancy and our partners our work. We have gone from helping communities and states and otherwise develop individual trails, some of them really long, like Elroy Sparta. But because of the success of the movement in the last 50 years, we're now looking at connectivity. How do we connect these long trails to each other? How do we connect trails in more urban areas into networks that really allow people to move through these urban areas and get to places they want to go? And one of the great examples of that in Wisconsin is what we call the Route of the Badger. And Route of the Badger is one of our Trail Nation projects, a small suite of projects around the country that we are really trying to help prove this connectivity concept and show people how to do it and work with people on doing it. And Route of the Badger is in southeast Wisconsin. We're talking Milwaukee, Racine, Kenosha, Waukesha, where there's already 350 miles of amazing multi-use trail. And the goal of this project is to connect everything together into a 700-mile seamless network. And it's the number of nonprofit and public agency partners that have been working on this with us for years now is astounding. And the progress has been great. And when you look at a map of Wisconsin, there's a lot of metro areas where this connectivity work, is already in progress, but there's also such huge potential for connecting some of the long distance corridors. If you look at a trail map of Wisconsin, a multi-use trail map, it is not at all hard to see that there's a real opportunity to connect the lake, the lakefront in Milwaukee. It's almost all the way connected to Madison now. It's really, really close. And then from Madison, you can see that there's already some long distance trails, including the Elroy Sparta, that would eventually get you up to La Crosse. And think about a lake to river corridor from Milwaukee to La Crosse that would cross the entire state of Wisconsin. What an amazing amenity for the people in Wisconsin, but also what an amazing amenity for people all over the world would come and use something like that.
Eric, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That was Eric Oberg, Midwest Regional Director for Rails to Trails Conservancy. He talked with us about the history of Rail to Trail in Wisconsin and the Elroy Sparta Trail, the first one in the nation. This conversation came from multiple audience questions as part of our Why Wisconsin project. Do you want to know something related to Wisconsin? Submit your question and we might tackle it in a future story. Go to WPR.org/WhyWisconsin. That's WHYWisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around, there's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.